Today, this morning, we are here on case number 84142, Ruag, I'm not sure if that's how you say it, versus Archon. I just want to note that Chief Justice Stiglitz couldn't be present with us here today, but she is listening to the arguments and she is participating in the decision regarding this matter. So, with that, Ms. Dove, are you arguing today?
No, Mr. Cox, sorry.
Mr. Cox, okay. Oh, got it. I see it written right over there. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay. So what'll happen, just so you know, well, you're actually, because we set this for an hour, you have 30 minutes. So when it gets down to 5 minutes, the yellow light will come on and there'll be a tone to kind of warn you, but the clock keeps running. So if you're still standing there when it gets to zero, you're out of time.
Understood.
Okay, go ahead.
Hey, thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. My name is Christopher Cox. I am counsel for the RUAG entities appellants. And before we get into the three issues that the court asked us to address, I'd like to take the moment to note that this is an opportunity for the court to reinforce some first principles of Nevada law that favor arbitration and reject attempts to vitiate negotiated arbitration agreements when they're valid and binding. And here what we have is an issue that's fairly rare in that we have non-signatories on each side of the agreement either seeking to enforce it or fighting it. And it's a unique opportunity, but it can still be decided under the existing principles of Nevada law in that you have to determine whether or not there's a valid contract to arbitrate and whether the scope of the dispute falls within the arbitration clause or whether it should be sent off to an arbitrator to decide based on the language the parties chose. And here we have a case where each side delegated some.
I'm sorry, let me ask you a question about that, because you just said the language the party chose. And that's one thing I struggle a little bit with this case, is that neither of the parties chose this language here. So how is it equitable to force someone to arbitration when they didn't agree to that?
Well, I'll get into that with regard to the different questions that the court posed, but I'll just answer it this way. This is a situation where you have RUAG Hungary and Arsenal ATF sign the agreement. They both delegated performance obligations out to other related parties. And when you delegate that authority and someone performing under the agreement, they should be bound by all the terms of the agreement, not just the supply timelines and the cost of the guns and everything else. They have to abide by everything. And that's what we have here. And maybe what I'll do, Your Honors, I'll get into some of the questions that the court posed and it'll help illustrate my point. So,
counsel, would you agree that the preliminary matter, the court would have the court below would have to first find that the non-signatories were in fact bound by the existing arbitration clause, and then it would go to arbitration? Would you agree?
Well, no.
To determine arbitrability, I mean, but as a, they have to be bound first, right? Before you can.
No, there has to be a valid binding arbitration provision. Whether the parties are bound by that provision is a question for the arbitrator under our contract, ICC, or for the court. But first, you have to determine whether or not there's an existing contract that has an arbitration provision. And the reason that's important is because if it had to be a contract between the parties in the first instance, you would never have a non-signatory who is bound by an agreement because they didn't sign it. And that was one of the problems that the trial court had, was if you read the transcript of the hearing, the trial court just ruled that she can't compel arbitration because the two parties who were involved did not sign the contract. But that's not the law. The law is if the case is grounded in the contract and someone is a beneficiary under the contract or acting as an agent for a signatory to the contract, they are also bound by it. And that's what we have here. So if
but shouldn't that threshold determination be made by the district court? I mean, I understand the issue of arbitrability in general has to go under the ICC. This is the FAA ICC issue. But you have to first get factually to say that these are agents, principals, beneficiaries, there's estoppel, something going on there that then subjects you to this arbitration clause. And once we reach that determination, then you can, any other issues that have to do with the arbitration clause then go to the arbitrator?
I think that it's slightly different than that.
Okay.
I think the first thing you have to look at is there a valid binding arbitration provision?
Mm-hmm.
It's not too broad, it's not one-sided, whatever. That's a question of law for the trial court to decide. And here, it's undisputed that we have four contracts. We have three contracts that were originally signed in 2017, the wholesale agreement, the distribution agreement, and the supply agreement. And the question that the court has to ask itself is the arbitration provision in those contracts valid and enforceable? That's a question of law. And the answer is yes. Then there's a threshold determining of whether or not the scope of the arbitration clause covers the dispute at issue. And that's going to address two different things. It's going to address the dispute between the parties, and it's also going to address whether the parties fall within the scope of that arbitration provision. And under ICC rules, that actually should go to the arbitrator to decide.
To decide the issue about whether these parties are parties bound by that clause.
Yes, whether it covers that dispute. And but even if it didn't, the facts here that are in the record compel a finding that they are. So the first issue that the court presented for us was to identify where in the record we have evidence of the relationship between the and among the RUAG entities and how it affects everything. So I wanted to point out some places. The appendix is very big, and the table of contents is somewhat confusing. But the first thing is we had two motions set before the court just to reset everybody.
Mr. Cox, can I just go back and ask you a question? So if you look at Article 6 of the ICC Rules of Arbitration, right, and that's the relevant provision here because there's nothing in the contract that talks about the arbitrator determining arbitrability. It says if any party raises one or more pleas concerning the existence, validity, or scope of the arbitration agreement, or concerning whether the claims can be determined together, it doesn't say anything about the arbitrator determining whether a non-signatory is bound by a contract.
Well, I would disagree slightly, Your Honor, in that part of the scope, whether that dispute falls within the scope of the arbitration provision, is necessarily going to require a determination as to whether the parties are subject to it. And it can't simply be a signatory, non-signatory decision as to whether the court addresses it or not. For example, here we have RUAG Holding, which is a holding company. We have RUAG USA. There are no allegations about anything that they did. But they're being sued for supplying faulty pistols, which only could be made pursuant to the underlying agreements. They have every right to go have the arbitrator decide whether or not the claims as alleged apply to them and whether, you know, they get the benefits and protections of the arbitration clause. Because it necessarily goes into what are the claims and what are the claims involved, who's being accused of what.
So what you're saying is that the word scope encompasses whether non-signatories are bound by the arbitration clause in the first place?
A case on that point that it is a threshold issue for determining arbitrability. And
I would understand that with signatories. There's no question that if you have a delegation clause or you reference the ICC, absolutely, no matter how absurd the relationship may be in terms of whether or not the arbitration provision applies. But if you have non-signatories, I would think, and you're right, that, you know, there is law in Nevada that allows signatories about non-signatories and vice versa. We haven't had anything where there's two non-signatories yet. But I would think as a threshold matter that if the district court were to find and do the factual analysis, because you're making all these factual claims that they're the beneficiaries of the contract and whatnot, I think as a threshold matter, if the court finds that there's no relationship, that they weren't the beneficiaries, then there would be no, she couldn't compel the parties to arbitration and the non-signatories.
I think in making that initial determination, we do it in a few ways, and I'm not telling Your Honor anything you don't know already, but a lot of times with arbitration agreements, we do make a decision as to whether or not someone falls outside the scope of the arbitration clause. And then typically you might stay that case against that other individual, let the arbitration proceed for judicial economy to avoid inconsistent rulings, and then see what comes back from the arbitrator. Or you kick it to the arbitrator, and the arbitrator will make a decision as to who stays and who goes in the arbitration process.
Okay.
And we're all here learning this at the same time, because there's not a lot of law on it. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to, you know, apply the law as it currently exists, saying, you know, this court doesn't really need to change the law simply because there's two non-signatories, right? So I think wherever Your Honor comes out as to who decides which parties are covered, I lost my train of thought there, but when the court decides, you know, who's in and who's out, you can still, apply whatever the law is on incorporation of rules into whatever your decision is.
Okay.
So my co-counsel handed me a cheat sheet. We just cited in our brief at page 14, our reply brief at page 14, the Insurnia versus Danville Reg Med Center case, which is 2022 WL 4076113, and that's from the West Virginia, but it collects cases. And in that case, they hold that in addition to the 6th, 8th, and 10th circuits, various district courts have explicitly held that arbitrators, not courts, must decide whether non-signatories are entitled to enforce valid arbitration provisions against signatory plaintiffs. So,
well, you've got different positions throughout the country, the Herrera case, and looking at the equitable estoppel principles. So we don't have anything point to here in Nevada, but you've got both sides of this equation.
And in Nevada, the court has followed Fourth Circuit precedent before, and we've cited it. As I mentioned before, I'm not coming here saying there's a brick wall of law. We're trying to get to the right result. And the point I'm trying to emphasize here is it's not whether there are non-signatories on either side of the V. It's whether when you apply existing law to each side of the V, do you come out to a place where two non-signatories can be bound to an arbitration agreement? And I submit the answer has to be yes, because you have to have both sides of the equation. You can't say a defendant is subject here and a plaintiff is subject there, but if they're both non-signatories, none of the law applies. That's just impractical and never work.
Are Archon's claims predicate, I know there was a First Amendment complaint where they took out the breach of contract. I think that was probably intentional because of this arbitration issue. But are Archon's claims nonetheless still based on the obligations between the original contracting parties, RUAG, Hungary, and ATF?
I want to get into that, because if you actually look at the wholesale agreement, what happens is Arsenal keeps distribution rights for these pistols in the United States and the rest of the world, and RUAG keeps them for Europe, right? So RUAG had the obligation to manufacture these pistols and send them to the United States, wherever Arsenal wanted them, so they could be distributed. And in one of my modules, to answer issue number two, We'll get into the evidence that's there, but basically there are declarations submitted to the court with regard to the personal jurisdiction, but from Archon's people.
I have one question about the cases that you alluded to on page 14 of your reply. And just judging by your description of them, it looks as though it's in at least that it is the non-signatory who is enforcing the arbitration agreement against the signatory and the delegation in that context. Do you think it matters that when it is the party against whom it's being sought to be enforced is the non-signatory?
I don't think it makes any difference. And the reason is this. One of the questions we're asked is, what are the practical and legal implications of allowing non-signatories, you know, on either side? And the practical ones are enormous, because what we have here, and we have the evidence, I'm happy to cite it to you, to the court, I have it in front of me. Arsenal had distribution rights in the U.S. They had a company called Arsenal USA. It was based in Nevada. In the end of 2017, they issued a press release, and they announced, and we have declarations from Archon on this, that they had a trademark problem with using the name Arsenal, so they renamed themselves Archon. Adrian Chavez, who was the head of Arsenal USA, is the head of Archon USA. They share the same address in Nevada. And
I was hoping Ms. Dove told you that.
Yeah, I said I'd have to catch myself. But the declaration says, and it's Moeller Declaration, which is the second appendix at pages 211, 213. Mr. Moeller said Arsenal rebranded the Strike B pistol and formed Archon because of a trademark dispute in the United States. That was from a RUAG witness, so I don't want to mislead anybody. But then there's the Lund Declaration, which is an Archon. And Mr. Lund did his declaration at paragraph 15, which is second appendix 245 to 259, states that Archon was previously known as the Arsenal Firearms, the pistol was previously known as the Arsenal Firearms Strike B pistol, but they were forced to change because of a trademark dispute with Arsenal Inc., another company. Then he goes on in paragraph 3, Archon was formed on January 22nd, 2018 for the primary purpose of selling the Archon firearm type B pistol. That's the Archon's own witness. Okay, so we're not talking about some incidental beneficiary. What we're talking about is an associated party with Arsenal who signed the contract, who was hired to perform the distribution in the United States by Arsenal, a signatory, and then they just had to change their name and change the name of the pistol. And there's more evidence that we have.
Mr. Fox, let me ask you, are you taking the position that the district court never has a gatekeeping function in arbitration provisions? I mean, I'm sure you know we had some disagreement last year in our Uber and Airbnb cases about that issue, but at least in that case, both of the parties at issue were signatories to a contract. So, I mean, how far does the line drop down before the district court has the ability to step in when you have people that haven't signed the agreement?
Well, I think a good principle is, and this is good for policy, has this non-signatory been hired to delegate out a performance obligation? And is the other non-signatory bound to perform under the contracts for that third-party delegate? Because if you could just vitiate an arbitration clause by delegating performance to a third party and just raise your hand and say it's a non-signatory, which is basically what happened in this case, that's not equitable in any way. And so,
would that not also violate the general rule that arbitration agreements need to be enforced the same as any other contract, like the neutral enforcement policy?
I don't think that violates anything. I think
but I mean, if you allowed them to just say, "Oh, I didn't sign," but it was, you know.
But that's what we have here, and what the trial court did here was basically say, I have people, they don't have a contract together, no arbitration, I'm done. That can't possibly be the law, because that's just inequitable, because what it leads to is a situation where if I want to get out of a contract, all I need to do is bring in somebody who's not a party to the contract and outsource some of my performance obligations. It can't possibly be, you know, a policy that Nevada would like. But that's what we have here. And the same is true with regard to the RUAG entities. If you look at the Kiner declaration, he gets into the relationship amongst the parties, which was issue number one the court asked us to address. And what he said was RUAG Holding is this is paragraph 5 of his declaration at 218. RUAG Holding is a wholly owned subsidiary of BGRB Holding AG, a private Swiss holding company that's wholly owned by the Swiss government. Paragraph 6. RUAG Hungarian Amotech, RUAG Hungary, RUAG Amotech GmbH, RUAG Germany, and RUAG Amotech USA are wholly owned by RUAG Amotech Deutschland GmbH, which is in turn wholly owned by RUAG Deutschland GmbH, which is in turn wholly owned by RUAG Holding. That is the relationship, which means they're all affiliates under the definition of affiliate in the contract, okay? Which means that they're allowed to see confidential information, they're allowed to perform under the contract, and that's exactly what RUAG Germany did. They were brought in as an affiliate for RUAG Hungary to assume the production obligations from 2018 until 2019. And
in that motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction, I believe there was an affidavit, I can't remember from whom, where they were touting the distinctions between the RUAG entities. Is that?
Yes, and I can explain that, okay. Your Honor. So for personal jurisdiction, one of the problems we had with the complaint was that Barkhan lumped all the RUAG defendants into one. And we said one's a holding company, one's in Germany, one does this. They're separate operating companies, and you have to assess personal jurisdiction individually as to each defendant, whether it's reasonable to hail them into court in a foreign state. And so what we put in that declaration was that they are separate operating companies. They have their own P&Ls. They make their own decisions. It's not piercing a corporate veil, because if you read the complaint, we were lumped together as one, you know, massive entity. And the fact of the matter was, RUAG Hungary signed the contract, assumed the duty to supply the pistols, as written in the contract, to Arsenal, and they were allowed to have one of their affiliates take up the manufacturing. And simply because RUAG Germany assumed the manufacturing as an affiliate, perfectly legitimate under the agreement, they have every right to enforce that agreement, because everything they're doing is with regard to a performance obligation to supply pistols. And that's what they did. And that's the most important thing to underscore here, right? Which is, if all the claims arise out of the performance under the contract, and you don't have a single claim that stands on its own, separate and apart from the underlying agreements, the arbitration provision, it's unfair to say you get get out of jail free card because you didn't sign this, because they were getting the direct benefit under the contract, because they were formed specifically to perform this function under the contract. How can you say that they're not an intended beneficiary?
But if there's a reference in the contract to affiliates, then, as you've been talking about, and of course I've got the contracts here, why does the arbitration provision only talk about the parties? Why doesn't it say the parties and affiliates? You know, these are sophisticated entities doing million-dollar transactions. Why don't they write in the contract what they mean?
Well, because under the law, if someone has derived the rights and benefits under contracts, we see contracts asserted all the time. And they probably weren't thinking about farming out performance obligations when they signed the contract in 2017. They didn't know that Archon was going to need to be formed in 2018 when they signed this agreement.
Right.
But they did. And the fact of the matter is, Every single claim comes from an alleged breach by RUAG and the RUAG entities united as one in failing to provide the sufficient quantity and quantity, quality and quantity of guns. That is a performance obligation of RUAG. They get every benefit of the doubt that the arbitration provision applies. And simply because Arsenal USA changed its name to Archon and changed the name of the pistol doesn't change the fact that this really is a dispute between the parties and affiliates.
But the Arsenal entity that changed its name to Archon is not the Arsenal entity that's a party to the contracts, though.
No, the Arsenal entity, party to the contract, who has the U.S. distribution rights, is the Cyprus entity.
Right.
They're the only ones who signed it. So what they did is they delegated out to their subsidiary, Arsenal USA, until Arsenal USA couldn't do it. Right. And then they didn't change their address. And there's even one statement, and this was in the petition to remove, but Adrian Chavez, who is the head of, I'm down to 5 minutes, so I'll just finish this, but Adrian Chavez, who is the head of Arsenal USA, when he made the change in the announcement to Archon, said, the company will continue to operate in its current structure and your contacts will remain unchanged. Other than these visible changes, there's no change in ownership and no change in staff. Our office location, phone, and fax numbers will remain the same. And that is at 1 App 36-40. And so this is not a situation where some random third party got sucked into an arbitration clause and it'd be unfair to assert it against them. And so I have 4 minutes and 14 seconds left. I'll hold for rebuttal if the panel has no more questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Larson Welsh. I'm here on behalf of Archon Firearms, Inc. The issue here is not one of arbitrability. In the United States Supreme Court case in Henry Schein, as well as this court's recent decisions in Uber versus Roy's and Airbnb versus Rice, what was not at issue there, not in dispute, was that each of the parties to those lawsuits had entered into a contract. That is not the issue here. The issue here is whether there is an enforceable contract between Archon Firearms and RUAG Germany, and whether the parties clearly and unmistakably agreed to arbitration.
But if Arsenal Firearms delegated its manufacturing function to a subsidiary that was formed for the express purpose of fulfilling their contract with RUAG Hungary, why shouldn't they be bound by the arbitration agreement?
Because Archon's agreement is with Arsenal LTD. Archon is a separate entity from Arsenal USA. You can call it a name change, but the fact is it's a separate and new entity, and their agreement is with Arsenal USA, or Arsenal LTD, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. So the express purpose of fulfilling the RUAG Hungary contract, right?
No, I would characterize it as fulfilling the agreement with Arsenal LTD and supplying the weapons from there. There was no
pursuant to the RUAG Hungary agreement, right? Because I think that in your initial complaint, the claims were based on a breach of that initial contract. And then I think when you guys saw that you were getting a little over your skis on the arbitration issue, you amended that complaint, took out all the breach of contract claims. However, your claims arise from the relationship between RUAG Hungary and Arsenal Firearms, yes, because of the manufacturing. There weren't enough being manufactured. The quality wasn't great, according to the complaint, but that is the basis of your claim, right?
It was at that time, but there's multiple bases to the complaint. And about that initial complaint that was filed, at the time it was filed, so as this court is well aware, the RUAG AF agreements, as they're referred to, were confidential. that confidentiality is taken seriously as they're filed under seal here. Archon was not a party to those. So at the time Archon filed its first complaint, its understanding of the RUAG AF agreements, which it had gathered over conversations with RUAG and with Arsenal over the years and the development of these pistols, was just that. It was just an understanding of what the agreements were. So we filed the complaint, right? And then part of it is, you know, now that we've seen the contracts for the first time.
Well, let me just stop right there, counsel. So Arsenal Firearms LTD, its contract with Archon has an identical arbitration provision, correct?
I'm sorry, say that again?
The subcontract between the production agreement between the Archon and Arsenal Firearms, right? There was a manufacturing contract there, right? The distribution contract had an identical arbitration clause in it as the contract between RUAG Hungary and Arsenal Firearms, right?
No.
It wasn't identical?
No, there is no arbitration agreement between Archon and any of the Arsenal entities or any of the RUAG entities.
So the distribution agreement, because we didn't see it, so I'm asking the distribution agreement between Arsenal Firearm and Archon wasn't in the record.
But there is no arbitration provision.
Okay, all right.
But counsel, the claims, I mean, if Archon, however you say it, is a stranger to the RUAG Arsenal contract, what basis does Archon have to sue RUAG then? If it's not because of the duties and obligations they have under those contracts. Otherwise, you're a stranger to that whole relationship.
Sure, I understand. But I think that it's very simple in that they got a product and the product was defective. It's as simple as that. Regardless of whether any agreements between any of these parties were entered into, if the company buys a defective product and it is that, they have some.
So it's still asserting claims under UCC, right, under Chapter 104 of the NRS. For express and implied warranties. And those provisions all govern duties from a seller to a buyer. So are they the seller and your client the buyer? Because that's the only way these provisions apply. I was studying these provisions earlier this week, and that's what they talk about. Duties of a seller to a buyer under the UCC.
Sure, and in an attenuated manner. I believe that they do. They do apply. But at issue here is not, I don't think, the merit of those claims. And I think that those claims, as they are now, that they properly stand, and we're naming as RUAG for their indirect providing of a product that Archon purchased.
But the implied warranties of merchantability, of fitness for a particular purpose, those are some of the claims that your client asserts. The implied warranties are implied in a contract between the parties, right? That's the meaning of the implied warranties, right?
I don't think that necessarily means that. I think that implied warranties can be derived from other ways other than an express written contract.
Okay.
Let me ask you a question about the motion to compel, the second motion to compel that the judge denied. It seems to me in that order that she interprets the arbitrability provision, despite the fact that the settlement agreement referenced the ICC rules and federal Ninth Circuit, state of Nevada, we've all recognized that reference to the ICC rules delegates authority to the arbitrator. So how did she not err by not delegating to the arbitrator the issue of arbitrability under that agreement?
So if I believe you said the second motion, if the second motion is referring to Arsenal,
the second motion to compel arbitration where the issue was the settlement agreement, and then the judge denied it and in her order seemed to go into the actual provisions of arbitration and whether it applied to the parties, kind of acknowledging that we have signatories here, but I'm deciding it because your order said she believes she possessed jurisdiction to decide it, despite the reference to the ICC rules and the settlement agreement.
Respectfully, I'm going to defer counsel for Arsenal is here, and I don't want to get myself in trouble by trying to answer his questions.
Okay.
Archon isn't a party to the settlement agreement. Is that correct?
Archon is not a party to this.
Understood. Okay.
So at the district court level, it was RUAG's burden to prove that there was an enforceable agreement that clearly and unmistakably had an arbitration clause. They could do this by one, proving the existence of a signed agreement, which they did not. It's undisputed that there's not a signed agreement between Archon and RUAG Germany. Alternatively, since they did not prove that, they had to show one, that RUAG Germany had a basis to enforce the RUAG AF agreements as a non-signatory non-party, and two, they had to establish that Archon was bound as a non-signatory and non-party. Regarding RUAG Germany's burden to establish that they could enforce the agreement, the district court correctly found that they did not meet that burden. RUAG Germany states that because it's an affiliate, there was a direct benefit to it, and therefore it was a third party beneficiary. First, I would say that affiliates in that agreement are not third party beneficiaries. They're merely incidental beneficiaries under Nevada law. Second,
why did you guys sue RUAG Germany? What was the basis of those claims? Being distinct from the RUAG Hungary entity, what was the basis for Archon to sue RUAG Germany?
So, generally speaking, the basis to sue the RUAG entities, all of them, was based on the fact that Archon could not distinguish between who exactly was doing what. In their mind, RUAG was some big, giant entity in Europe that had multiple parts to it, and they weren't specifically sure, I guess I would say.
So now that you know, with the benefit of some hindsight, would you say that RUAG Germany is an appropriate party in this case, having not been the manufacturer, I guess, under the contract?
Yes, I believe that some of the firearms that were shipped and received by my client were stamped or imprinted with RUAG Germany. Similar, at least, that they were manufactured in Germany.
So they did have some hand in the manufacturing, distribution, assembly of these guns in some way?
I believe so.
Okay.
So I'd like to get back to the question that Justice Herndon asked. Why wouldn't an arbitrator decide if this is a properly arbitrated case?
Because I think the first step in that analysis is whether the parties have clearly and unmistakably agreed to arbitration.
No, the clearly and unmistakably goes to the delegation to the arbitrator of the obligation to decide. I think it's ordinary contract construction rules govern whether there's an arbitration agreement.
Sure, and that's fair. I appreciate that distinguishment. But still, I guess that the two are related. Then the first step is to decide if there is a contract, if the parties have agreed to anything. And then the second step within that is, if there is an agreement, have they clearly and unmistakably agreed to arbitrate their claims? And I think that those are both properly before the district court to decide if it has jurisdiction to compel arbitration.
But it's looking at the claims and it's saying to Archon, you have no claim except for one that is derivative of the contract between the party asserting the arbitration clause. So that's a factor as well. It's not an abstract exercise.
Sure. And under Nevada law, if Archon's claims, if they directly benefit from the RUAG AF agreements, right, and a and if their entire case hinges on the RUAG AF agreements, then yes, they can be equitably estopped and bound to the contract and the arbitration provision. In this case, I would submit that there is no, Archon has no direct benefit from the RUAG AF agreements. I believe it's an indirect benefit. Any direct benefit that Archon had was by virtue of their agreement with Arsenal.
Wouldn't Archon's claims be limited to, I guess, against Arsenal, if that's who they have a relationship with? If they don't have a relationship with RUAG, what's the basis for claims against them? I don't understand.
I think it relates back to the core concept of a defective product, which I understand.
Was someone injured? I mean, are we talking about tort claims for injuries? Because otherwise, I don't know that we get beyond contract.
No, not yet. No, hopefully not, but not at this point.
Of course.
So, and the second part of that, the entire case, Archon's entire case, the second portion of equitable estoppel, also does not hinge entirely on the RUAG AF agreements. It hinges on Nevada law. And to take it one step further, the agreement it had with Arsenal. I'd like to point out too that the evidence presented to the district court regarding the RUAG entities attached to its motion to compel arbitration were three general things: a declaration from Christoph Eisenhardt, the RUAG AF agreements, three of them, and then three letters from RUAG Hungary terminating the agreements. There was no evidence presented of the relationship of the RUAG entities. That was in a separate motion, and the district court expressly did not consider that in their finding. And I guess as a final point here, in its order, the district court found that neither RUAG Germany nor Archon were parties to the RUAG AF agreements. It also found that RUAG Germany failed to establish any basis by which it could enforce the RUAG AF agreements. And finally, that RUAG Germany failed to establish any basis to bind Archon to the RUAG AF agreements. I will turn over the remainder of the time to counsel for Arsenal.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Christopher Kircher. I represent the Arsenal parties, which are Arsenal Firearms Limited, AF Protech Group, KFT, and Arsenal Firearms USA. I know the majority of the morning is focused on the issues between Archon and RUAG, but really the issue between RUAG and the Arsenal parties, the focus should be related to the transfer and settlement agreement that was entered into between Arsenal Limited, AF Protech, RUAG Germany, RUAG Hungary, and a couple other parties that aren't parties to this agreement, or that aren't parties to this litigation. That was entered into a year and a half after the litigation was initiated.
Right. So during the litigation, they enter a settlement agreement and then add cross claims against the parties they just settled with. Do I have that right?
The cross claims were already pending. They were already alleged in federal court a year before. We had breach of contract claims and as well as the indemnification and contribution claims. The settlement agreement, the transfer and settlement agreements, which was confidential under seal, I won't get into a lot of specifics related to it, but it did not mention the lawsuit whatsoever, Archon's claims, or indemnification and contribution. So once this agreement was entered into in the summer of 2021, which is about a year and a half after the lawsuit was filed, we ended up amending the cross claims, removing all the claims except for equitable indemnification and contribution. The breach of contract claims went away because arguably those fell within the settlement agreement under the release.
And should the current motion to compel arbitration for the settlement agreement moving to, I guess they're just trying to dismiss the counterclaims there, or the cross claims. No, I was right, counterclaims. should that be, should that threshold question be answered by the arbitrator?
No.
And why not?
I guess the first question is whether that a court should take is there a valid arbitration agreement? And as it relates to it, there is only certain parties to the settlement, the transfer and settlement agreement.
Sure.
And they did include, for example, Arsenal USA.
But couldn't the arbitrator ferret that out?
But I think there should be, it has to be the first step for a court to analyze is there a valid arbitration agreement?
Well, there's a contract with an arbitration agreement. I think we can all agree on that, right?
Correct.
So at that point, shouldn't the arbitrator be the one to determine who falls within that arbitration clause?
In this situation, I say no. And the reason being is that when you look at the transfer and settlement agreement as a whole, that and looking at the precedent from Schein and this court's rulings and Uber and Airbnb, there has to be clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties agreed to delegate the issue of arbitrability to an arbitrator. Our position is that there isn't.
How does the reference to the ICC rules play into that?
Well, first, I'd say that Schein didn't say as a matter of law by just referencing rules that say that jurisdiction should be decided by an arbitrator is enough to be clear and unmistakable evidence. I think a court should look at not only that, but all the evidence that was presented before it to determine whether the parties decided to delegate that issue to an arbitrator.
There are multiple cases holding that the AAA rules, which have a similar provision, do constitute a delegation clause.
That's correct. And I acknowledge that there are multiple cases that say that. But again, I don't think that's the be-all, end-all of the court's analysis. I don't think the court's analysis should be, are the parties the same and does it reference the rules? Then that's it. I think that the court should look at whatever evidence presented before it, and if it doesn't show that it was clear and unmistakable that the parties intended to delegate.
What is present here that would indicate those entities who were actually parties to the settlement agreement did not have a delegation clause?
Well, I guess the first point I would make is that the RUAG parties didn't really provide any other evidence other than the agreement itself. Okay. So it's their burden to prove that. Second, when you review an agreement, the transfer and settlement agreement as a whole, you will see that it wasn't meant to include this dispute, first off. And second off, the actual dispute.
Isn't that the very kind of thing that delegation clauses delegate to arbitrators?
Well, the actual arbitration provision at issue in the transfer and settlement agreement says all disputes arising out of or in connection with this agreement shall then be finally settled under the rules of the ICC.
Right.
This isn't, and the indemnity and contribution claims have nothing to do with this agreement.
It's not in connection with the agreement?
No.
So it has nothing to do with gun manufacturing or distributing or?
It does in a general sense, but really it's based upon Archon's claims against the Arsenal parties. If Archon did not have claims against the Arsenal parties, then we wouldn't have those indemnification and contribution claims. So it isn't a contractual indemnification claim. It's an equitable indemnification claim.
Let me go back and ask just kind of a predicate question. What standard of review should we be applying here? We've got the idea of contract interpretation, equitable estoppel. We've got various comments today and in the pleadings about factual findings of the court. Do you apply de novo review, no matter what the basis of the motion to compel arbitration is? Do you mesh some abuse of discretion, clearly erroneous standard in there? How do we do that here?
Well, I believe the initial inquiry related to is there an arbitration agreement? That's a factual finding made by the court. Reviews of contract interpretation, that's de novo. That is by the court to review those contract interpretation. I believe, though, that the district court, when she reviewed the transfer and settlement agreement at issue, which should be the only agreement this court relies upon as it relates to the Arsenal parties and RUAG, that in reviewing the entire contract, not just the names of the parties and that one specific provision, found that there wasn't a valid arbitration provision to delegate or a delegation clause to delegate that issue to the arbitrator. And again, as this court knows, the standard for a delegation clause is clear and unmistakable evidence. And I think when you look at the evidence as a whole, in this case, there isn't an express delegation clause like there was in Uber and Airbnb. And so it's really relying upon the reference to the ICC rules. But that being said, looking at the release from the agreement, I mean, it doesn't mention this lawsuit. It does mention the three agreements that are at issue between Archon and RUAG. And it says it's in connection with their business relationship.
There were three agreements between Archon and RUAG?
Oh, I'm sorry. The questions the court had. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. It's confusing. Yeah, those three contracts in RUAG, Hungary, and Arsenal Limited. So,
got
sorry.
It.
But I meant the questions the court had about those.
Counsel, did Arsenal Firearms delegate its duties under the contract with RUAG Hungary to Archon?
My response to that would be no, but Archon's role in this transaction was to be the United States distributor of the pistols. RUAG was a manufacturer of pistols. At one point it was RUAG Germany. Then at one point it appears that RUAG Hungary took over at least the production of the pistols. Again, we're at the very early stages of this litigation. RUAG hasn't filed an answer. No discovery has been completed.
No, but the question is about your client's duties under the contract and whether it assigned its obligations to Archon.
Is that what your question is?
Yeah, because there was a distribution agreement, correct, between Hungary and Arsenal Firearms, LTD?
And that distribution agreement related to distribution in Europe.
Okay.
That's the distinction. So Archon was meant to be the distributor in the United States.
Was it created for that purpose?
Archon?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that, but I think I would probably say yes. I'm not 100% sure about that.
Is Archon a related entity to your clients?
No. Separate and completely different entity. I mean, there was evidence presented before the federal court. Which, you know, didn't come up before the district court, that my client, Arsenal Limited, has no ownership interest in Archon, and Archon has no ownership interest in Arsenal Limited.
Was that the case from the outset of Archon, or is that subsequent?
That's my understanding. I will say on the record that Adrian Chavez, who is the owner of Archon, was or may still be the manager of Arsenal USA, which was supposed to be the original distributor.
Did they share an address?
From what I've seen, the answer would be yes.
Phone number, fax number?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. So he may be a manager of Arsenal, but not an owner of it.
Correct. And Arsenal Limited, the Cyprus company, is a completely separate company from Arsenal USA. There is a relationship there, and there was a relationship there. But that was the original company, the Cyprus company, that contracted with RUAG Germany and then RUAG Hungary for the three agreements.
The guns that Archon was contracted with an Arsenal entity to distribute in the U.S. were guns that Arsenal was contracting with RUAG to manufacture. Is that accurate?
That's correct, with RUAG, Hungary, and Germany.
Correct.
And the other party, well, let me take a step back. Arsenal, there were written contracts with RUAG Hungary. For sure, I know that for a fact that RUAG Germany was involved, but really, Arsenal's perspective was RUAG is producing this.
Right.
You know, and even though there isn't a written contract, RUAG is a large company with multiple subsidiaries. It was, at the beginning, RUAG was producing these.
So then would you agree that they would be able to take advantage of the arbitration clause, because it's all one, just RUAG was making these guns, and so as an affiliate of the actual signatory, because you're treating them all as one, why wouldn't they be able to enforce the arbitration agreement?
I mean, we haven't taken a position on that, to be quite honest, but I think really the court's review, similar to what we're doing with the transfer and settlement agreement, is actually looking at what the agreement says. And I think one of the justices raised that the arbitration provision doesn't include subsidiaries, affiliates, or anything else like that. It just mentions party or parties. So continuing on my last couple minutes, I think that the issue is here is that the court, which the district court did, was look at the agreement as a whole. You can't look at the arbitration provision and the reference to the ICC rules in a vacuum. You have to look at the agreement as a whole and what the arbitration provision says, what the release says, and the purpose of it. I think that typical when ongoing litigation is happening, if the purpose of it was to completely resolve and settle it, there was a broad release. It usually, I've never seen it otherwise, mentions the lawsuit at issue. And in this case, that just didn't happen. This was to resolve the business relationship disputes between RUAG and Arsenal Limited and Arsenal, or AFCO Tech, and the non-party to this. But it did not resolve the issues of indemnification and contribution. RUAG knew that this case was going on. RUAG knew that those cross-claims had already been asserted, yet they did not include those in the transfer and settlement agreement that was ultimately entered into.
That doesn't seem like that's exactly what the purpose of a delegation provision is and what Henry Schein has instructed all of us to do, which is let the arbitrator decide if it's within the scope of the arbitration provision or not.
Yeah, Henry Schein, I'm not arguing that. I think, though, again, that just can't look at just it has to look at all the evidence to determine if there was clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties intended that. In this, there isn't an express delegation clause, and they're relying upon just a reference to the ICC rules. And the district court, which I think she appropriately did, was look at the entire agreement when ruling on to determine whether this dispute, contribution and indemnification, fell within this arbitration provision, which it didn't. Again, the arbitration provision only relates to arising out of or in connection with this agreement. And this agreement had nothing to do with the lawsuit. With that, I believe my time is up, so I'll end it there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. A brief rebuttal here. First, I'd like to address the Arsenal arguments. The first thing I'd like to say is this is not just about the arbitration provision or the ICC reference. It has to do with paragraph 14 of the settlement agreement, which is headed full and final agreement. Subject to the duties under this agreement, the parties shall consider to be fulfilled by this agreement all existing obligations, rights, and claims from the assembly agreement, supply chain agreement, and wholesale agreement, and from all orders related to the mentioned agreement and the pistols. There are no further claims and rights from one party to the other, and all disputed points and claims in connection with their business relationship to the pistols are regarded as finally settled. That seems pretty broad.
I'm sorry, because we have such limited time. I took some pause when counsel for Arsenal mentioned that it was not really a delegation of its duty to Archon because Archon was going to be the U.S. distributor, which was not something that was contemplated in the contract between the contracts between RUAG Hungary and Arsenal Firearms. It was limited to a distribution in Europe. So how do you...
There are two things to unbundle there.
Okay.
One is RUAG was supposed to manufacture the Strike B pistols for everywhere. Under one of the three agreements, they carved out the right to also distribute those pistols in Europe. And Arsenal held the right to distribute those pistols everywhere else, including in the U.S. They were originally going to use Arsenal USA, but because of the trademark dispute, they formed Archon. And Archon is the one who we've never seen the agreement. It's not in the record. We don't know if it's written or oral. But they apparently have an agreement where RUAG delivers to Arsenal the pistols under the agreement, and then Arsenal uses Archon to distribute them. That's my understanding, but we haven't seen the contract. Two other points quickly before my 2 minutes runs out. One, clean and unmistakable reference for the ICC. What I'd submit to your honors is, yes, sometimes people use belts and suspenders and they say the arbitrator is going to decide arbitrability. But it is clear and unmistakable when you incorporate ICC or AAA rules. What would be unmistakable is if you said, but the court, we're going to reserve things for the court and the arbitrator shall not determine arbitrability. That would be clear and unmistakable that they do not want an arbitrator to decide arbitrability, but they don't have that. And the case law says by incorporating the rules, that's good enough. One last point. We heard this, I think we addressed it in our reply brief. Your Honor is right on the money, which is, what's the basis for a claim from Archon against RUEC? We don't know. We just have an arbitration provision. We're trying to get there. But if you look at the allegations, everything comes under what we were supposedly obliged to do under the contract, supply a certain amount of pistols, warrant merchantability. And as the court understands, this was all to Arsenal, not to Archon. And what I heard Mr. Welch say was, well, that's not the entire case. It also relies on Nevada law. But RUEC Germany has no obligation to ship pistols to Nevada to Archon, except through the contract where it's required to supply pistols throughout the world in Arsenal's distribution realm. So how could it be that Nevada, there's no Nevada law that requires RUEC Germany to be shipping pistols to the United States or anywhere else. But with that, I'm done and I'll submit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks for your arguments today. The matter will